The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's
the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting for seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. And another exciting program. We're going to be going to Mars and the surface of the Mars in just a few minutes. First, a couple of announcements. And the first announcement is a Space Show congratulations to Mr. Musk and everybody at SpaceX for a superb launch of the initial Falcon Heavy demonstration flight. I hope all of you had a chance to watch it live. If not live, watch the replays of it. It's pretty spectacular. They recovered two of the three boosters, and hopefully it'll be on its way to this orbit where the Tesla is going to be driving around the sun and crossing the path of Mars for many, many, many eons of time. So, again, congratulations, Elon, and everybody at SpaceX. I think at one point they mentioned 6,000 SpaceX employees had signed a photograph or a plaque or something that was also in the fairing. So we congratulate each and every one of those. Don't worry, I won't read their names on air. We don't have that kind of time. You can call us tonight, and our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient and let the phone ring, and we'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. The toll-free number is our preferred way of reaching the Space Show, but you can also do that through email, and that is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, or through our blog, which is on our homepage, thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the right is upcoming show, and that's a menu item. This is the first show listed. It's also our blog page for this show. So you open it up, and down at the bottom is a place for you to comment or post questions. As soon as you do that, I'll get a copy of it and can integrate your comment or question into the program tonight. Also, at our website, again, thespaceshow.com, there is a detailed website newsletter, and it shows everything in more detail than the email newsletter does for the week that we are in on the Space Show. And then if you scroll down, it shows who we have booked for upcoming programs. And we're closing in on completing the first quarter of 2018 booking. If you have guests that you would like us to invite to the Space Show, please let me know. We'd be happy to receive your suggestions and contact the person you're interested in referring to the Space Show. Everything we do is archived. You can easily listen to our programs right off of our website or download them. Upper left is a menu, there's a couple of things I want to draw your attention to. So for those of you interested in T-shirts and logo wear, there is a menu called Support in the upper left. So check it out. You'll see our Cafe Press store. And then there's also a Listen Live button. So this tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs, all of the archive programs, and our podcasting programs, including Alexa. Feel free to share this information with other people. We get a lot of requests for how do we hear Space Show programs, and just follow these instructions. And, of course, if anyone has any questions, they're welcome to email me again, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then center right is a Support the Space Show area. So this is probably the most important part because this is what keeps the Space Show on air. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, giantleapfoundation.org. And your gifts do keep the Space Show going and keep us being able to provide you with quality guests like we're going to be doing this evening. So remember, as a 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, we give you a tax deduction for your gift. And for those of you paying taxes in California, we're a public benefit corporation over here, and you also get a tax deduction for your gift if you're a California taxpayer. So if you have any questions, do visit OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then just a reminder that in addition to the individual support, we do have sponsor support. And sponsors get their banner ad running across the website. You can change it as often as you like. And they also get a short message read by me on every live Space Show program that is full length or longer. The shorter Space Show programs have me thanking each sponsor, but I save time and don't read their messages. So we do have a few sponsorships left, and if you're interested, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And for tonight, our sponsors for the first segment are the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail, and their website is thespaceplan.com. They have discussions, regular updates, and other kinds of interactive features. And you can order your own full color poster of the plan, and there are two different kinds of plans. There's an academic plan and the regular space plan. It's useful, it's inspiring, and you will want to have it. So check it out at thespaceplan.com. And then also for the first segment, the Space Foundation sponsors us, and they have their 34th symposium coming up. This is April 16th through the 19th at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs. Engage with global space leaders and decision makers, again, at the 34th Space Symposium. For all the information you need, reservations, everything, go to spacesymposium.org. And that brings us to this evening's program, and I'm very happy to bring back to the Space Show JPL Dr. Ashwin Basavada, and he is the project scientist for Mars Science Lab. He's been doing that since 2015, and he's still doing it. Before that, he was a deputy project scientist for Mars Science Lab. He's been a co-investigator for Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Diviner Radiometer Project. I can go on and read about him, but I'd much rather talk with him. He does have his PhD in planetary science from Cal Institute of Technology, and he has a Bachelor of Science in Geophysics and Space Physics from UCLA. And he has a real interest in the studies of Mars with regard to surface properties, volatiles, and climate history. We're going to talk to him about the Martian surface and rovers. So, Ashwin, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you? And why don't you start out with giving us a rover Curiosity update?
Hi, great to be here. Yeah, thanks for having me back again. Yeah, let me give you a little bit of context for where we are with the mission. We launched in November of 2011, landed in 2012 August, so we are now more than 5 years on Mars, five and a half almost. And as I look on my Mars calendar here, we're on day, or Sol, Martian day, 1957 of the mission. So almost 2,000 Martian days on the surface. So the rover is doing really well, quite healthy. We're working through some technical issues here and there that we can talk about, but overall we're still working our way up a mountain in Gale Crater on Mars.
Have you lost any features or tools or anything that you started out with on Curiosity, or is everything still working?
We're doing pretty well. You know, considering we're 5.5 years in, I would not have predicted that we have so many of our capabilities that we landed with. In terms of our scientific instruments, we've just lost one part of one instrument so far, which is our ability to measure the wind. Wind sensors and Mars' very thin atmosphere are really delicate instruments, and that stopped working about a year or maybe 2 years ago at this point. The other thing we're working through, which is quite significant, but we don't think it's lost at, you know, at this point, is our drilling system. The rover was really built around the ability to drill into rocks and analyze the drilled powder in laboratories. And for about a year, we've been without the drilling capability as we try to invent really a new way of drilling to make up for the fact that one of the drill motors has stopped working. And we can, I'd love to talk more about this because it's pretty exciting, but I'll just, summarize it by saying it's taken a year to figure out if we can get that motor working again. And then when that was not successful, to really just invent a whole new way of drilling.
And were you able to invent a whole new way?
Yeah. We spent, 5 or 6 months trying to recover that motor. And then about May or June of last year, we turned the corner and said, well, that's just not going to happen, so let's figure out how to drill without the ability to move the drill up and down on the end of the arm. And that's the particular motor that broke. We usually drill by putting the drill fixed against the surface of Mars, and then a separate motor on the end of the arm moves the drill up and down and actually does the drilling. With that motor no longer working, we now have invented a way to drill using the arm itself. So much like a human does, where you're actually holding the drill with the arm and using the arm to push in the drill to the surface, that works, but it's a lot less stable than when you have the arm fixed against the ground during drilling. So that's been the challenge.
Is this kind of like an old cable tool drilling thing where you'd raise up the drill bit and, you wouldn't be delicate. You'd just let it drop and hit back down to the ground and would have a sharp point on the end of it. And they just keep doing that until they made hole on it, as they used to say. Is that kind of what you're talking about, but it's more controlled?
It almost seems like the way we used to do it is more like a drill press, where the drill is held very rigidly and it just moves up and down.
Right.
Now we're kind of freehanding it. We got this 6-foot robotic arm with a drill at the end of it, no longer able to steady the arm against the ground while we're drilling, and instead just moving the drill with the arm, holding it extended and drilling that way. The challenge is that when you do that, when you're just starting to first make the hole into the rock, the drill bit just wants to bounce around everywhere, and we have to control that and make sure we can start the hole. And once we start the hole, we can actually drill pretty well.
And the arm is robust enough to do that?
Fortunately. This was really a big moment for our engineers on the mission to overcome this loss of a major motor on the rover and figure out how to use what's left to learn how to drill in a way that the rover was never intended to do. So we're glad that there was a solution. Half of it is just all these creative engineers in a room figuring out how to solve the problem with what we have available to us. And the other half is just sort of good luck that that a solution existed and the rover could handle it.
How far down can it drill in total?
We drill quite shallow because the only objective is to gather enough drill powder to put into the laboratory. So our typical drill holes are about 2.5 inches deep, and we hope that this new method will get about the same. We have not tested it on Mars yet, but we're just about to come back to drilling after a whole year, maybe within the next 2 weeks.
When you go back to Mars with another mission, how are you modifying the drilling to get around this problem?
There won't be an exact replica of Curiosity going, but the next Mars mission, which is called Mars 2020, does have a coring drill. We drill with a solid drill bit and create powder. What they're going to do is drill with a hollow drill bit and get a core of rock. But nevertheless, they could still have similar problems, and it's really not a problem with the drill as much as with the motor in the drill, which we believe what happened is that the dynamics of drilling, the shaking of the drill after 5 years, cause the motor to get stuck. And so the solution is just to acknowledge that and test the motors in the future more rigorously to figure out how to design them so they can handle that dynamic environment.
Interesting. So that's the only casualty after all this time, almost 6 years on the Mars surface?
It really is. You know, the wind sensors, I'd say, is the only casualty. The drill is only a casualty if it doesn't work in 2 weeks when we try it out. If it does, then we really declare victory, and then we're just left with the relatively minor loss of that wind sensor.
So what happened with the wheel problem we heard about early on?
Yeah, the wheel problem was something we had to work through about 1 year into the mission. We were driving along and occasionally taking pictures that showed parts of the wheels just by chance. And we started noticing that the wheels were getting really banged up much more quickly than we had expected. And it turned out it was because we were driving over some particularly bad, very sharp and hard rocks at that part of the mission. And we wore down the wheels pretty quick. So what we did was, first, we had a lot of our geologists on the team learn to recognize those particular rocks and help us avoid them. And then we spent about maybe a year and a half or so testing wheels at JPL in our Mars yard, our simulation area, and figuring out exactly how the wheels interacted with certain rocks. And coming up with a life estimate, really, of how long we expect the wheels to last, now that we've learned that they have this vulnerability. And the combination of driving more safely and then learning how, from all this testing, to protect the wheels better has allowed us to extend the life of the wheels now, we think, as long as we'll need them. So we're no longer worried that we'll lose the wheels. But if you see our pictures, you'll see that they are not a pretty sight.
They're taking a beating.
Yeah.
Mars 2020 have the same kind of wheels or improvements?
They have improvements. So, this is a good example of how they, because this problem was noticed almost, 4 or 5 years ago at this point, they had a lot of time to react to what we've learned about wheel design and about the geology of Mars. So they have redesigned their wheels to be a little thicker overall, because our vulnerability really was the sheet metal that was between the skeleton of the wheel, the treads, if you will. The treads are plenty strong, but there's sheet metal in between the treads that were getting holes poked in it. And so they've made their wheels a little thicker overall, and redesign the treads also to prevent certain rocks from getting in between them.
What is Curiosity still finding? What is the core of its exploration right now?
The core objective of the mission from the beginning was to figure out if Mars ever had conditions that could support life. We are in the middle of this great multi-decade Mars exploration program that first mapped out Mars using orbiters to look for places that once had water. And then we sent rovers like Spirit and Opportunity in 2004. They got to Mars and searched for evidence that water was there and were successful in finding it. I'm talking about ancient water in this respect. And then the next step after finding that Mars once had water was to see if Mars had all the other requirements of life, not just water, but nutrients for life, energy sources that life would require, and the lack of, hazards to life like toxic chemicals or radiation. And so Curiosity was equipped to do that. We were sent to a place, Gale Crater, that appeared to have pooled water in the ancient past, and we were equipped with these scientific laboratories, the ones that require the drill powder to analyze, to be able to detect all the trace chemicals and organic molecules and all the little hints that would tell us that Mars could have supported life if life ever took hold. So that's kind of a long introduction, but what we've been finding is fantastic. So we've now, from the ground, been able to confirm that rivers once flowed in Gale Crater, and the water gathered into lakes, and mud at the bottom of those lakes slowly turned into rock, which we study today. And now, after climbing over 1,000 vertical feet on this mountain inside the crater, we've confirmed that that entire 1,000 feet is a continuous record of ancient lakes on Mars. So this place was wet, and it was wet for a long time, and the kind of water that was in those lakes had all the right ingredients for life.
But you're not finding any ingredients of life or any dead fish or anything like that.
Yeah, we haven't been so lucky to find anything obvious for life. But the truth of it is, we are not equipped with this rover to find what we would expect to be there on Mars if life ever took hold. And what I mean by that is, you know, we were equipped to look for the environmental conditions, you know, like the how much water was there, how long did the water last, did it have the right elements in it. A future rover, the Mars 2020 orbiter in particular, will be equipped with a different set of instruments to actually make the very precise measurements, chemical measurements and biological measurements to detect trace forms of ancient life. It's a different kind of measurement and a much harder one. We weren't quite ready to do it 10 years ago when Curiosity was designed, but they will now follow up and do that.
You have your first caller on the show. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall, and I'm in Renfro, and I have an interesting question that kind of hit me, and that was all these Mars rovers have lasted a lot longer than their original life expectancy. And then I started looking at a lot of satellites that seem to live long past their expected life expectancy, with the one exception of if they run out of fuel, they run out of fuel. So, you know, there's that part. But, you know, like New Horizons, way past Pluto, you know, quite a few of the other satellites are just lasting longer than expected. Is that just conservative engineering, or is that a real surprise?
Yeah, it's a great observation. It certainly hasn't been like that throughout the entire era of space exploration, as I'm sure you would imagine. So it's a testament that to our engineering that we've learned how to create parts and moving, you know, mechanisms and electronics and all sorts of things that can survive in the very challenging atmosphere of space, you know, and even more challenging environment on the planet of a surface of a planet like Mars, with huge temperature differences day to night, you know, lots of dust flying around, getting into everything. I would agree with you that there's a conservatism to the engineering for sure, but it's sort of born out of decades of failures and challenges in trying to learn how to survive in this environment. I think at this point, I can't speak for JPL, but as a JPL employee and someone who works on these missions, I'd say that running out of fuel is the way you'd love to end your mission. It means that you designed everything else that still works until the end.
You did bring up something there that's interesting, and that is dust. Now, lunar dust is supposed to be not a caustic, but very scratchy, sharp-edged, et cetera, et cetera. Is that the way Mars regolith is?
Mars is probably a little friendlier because it's a little more Earth-like in the sense that things break down from wind and water, whereas on the moon, you're really just fracturing rock by impacts from meteors and things like that. So you get all these very sharp fragments. On Mars, those same fragments have now been ground down by rolling across the ground with as the wind blows, etc. The problem with Mars dust is it's really small. There's no oceans or lakes or anything on Mars anymore for the dust to get swallowed up by. So it's just flying around the surface, very fine particles, like the kind of things that would get in your lungs and be very toxic. So that's more of the challenge. For humans, I think it's breathing it. For machines, it's getting into all the gearing and electronics and solar panels.
Yeah, you get into the joints, and the joints stiffen up and wear out prematurely.
Yep.
But, hey, that's part of the first question. Thank you. Enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Thank you, Marshall. And, listeners, that clears the toll-free line if you would like to use it. And it is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Are you still finding really surprising discoveries? Are you getting startled every day, or are you finding more of the same that you've been finding in Gale Crater?
It's a little bit of both. So our first major discovery of the mission, which really satisfied the overall objective of finding these ancient life-friendly environments, was when we drilled into some rocks, even before we had gotten to the mountain that we've been climbing, and we drilled into those rocks, figured out they're made of minerals that had turned into clay through interaction with water, and then we looked around and through the geology figured out that we were actually drilling into an ancient lake bed. So finding that within the first year of getting to Mars was spectacular. And then we've actually, you know, just found more and more and more of that the higher we've climbed on the mountain itself. So this record of lakes, the layers of mud at the bottom of ancient lake now are stacked, you know, 1,000 feet high. So in that sense, it's repetitive, but not scientifically boring because it with every additional foot higher, it means those lakes were there for more and more time. So we think that these lakes now have existed for over 1 million years in ancient Mars, maybe 3 billion years ago. And that was surprising. We were thrilled to find a lake, but we thought maybe if it only lasted 100 years, that doesn't really tell us that much about the potential for life. But when you find a lake that was there for 1 million years, now you're giving, you know, biology, evolution, some time to work with. Although it's been repetitive, that's what has made it actually scientifically valuable.
So are the lakes 100% fresh water, or are they a combination?
The original first one we found was very fresh water, not too much salt dissolved in it. As we've climbed higher, there does seem to be a trend in the lakes getting a little bit more salty, which could mean they were shallower, for example, evaporating away, so the salts increased. It could mean that there was a warmer climate, so the rocks around it were eroding more quickly and contributing more minerals to the lake. We're trying to figure that out, but we do seem to be recognizing a trend that over time the lakes went from fresher to more saline.
Paul is in Detroit, and he has an email question for you. And he says, in terms of finding the lakes and the water and the traces, did you find out where the water went and why it went?
It's an interesting question. There's an overall story about Mars that we piece together, not just from our work at Gale Crater, but even from the mapping that's been done over the whole planet through the orbiter missions, which is that 3 or 4 billion years ago, Mars had a lot more water. That's when all the geological evidence exists for rivers and lakes and maybe even an ocean. And then sometime around 3 billion years ago, all that evidence vanishes. And the surface for the last 2 billion years, maybe even three, has been cold and dry. And our best understanding of why that big change happened was that it was coincident with Mars losing its magnetic field, and the loss of the magnetic field allowed the atmosphere to be stripped away by the sun. This happens, the potential for this can happen on any planet, where the sun emits a lot of high-energy particles that can hit atmospheric molecules and strip them off a planet. Earth has been protected by a strong magnetic field, fortunately. Mars had one early on, but it went away as the planet cooled, and the atmosphere became vulnerable to loss. And as you lost the thicker atmosphere and the water vapor that was in that atmosphere, the planet both cooled and dried. And so we think what we're seeing in Gale is probably a example of what happened across the whole planet.
How would it lose its magnetic shield? What force causes that to happen?
One way of thinking about it is in order to generate a magnetic field, you have molten material deep underground that's circulating, and that material, the metallic, you know, aspect of that material circulating around deep underground on Earth is what generates Earth's magnetic field. But once the planet cools too much, and the outer surface becomes thicker and thicker, and the inner surface becomes less and less molten, you can no longer generate the magnetic field that way. So on Earth, it's a big planet, and big planets just have more energy in them and take longer to cool, whereas Mars, being half the diameter of Earth and even less when you talk about, you know, surface area, it cooled faster, and as the cooling happened, it lost its magnetic field.
So Earth is cooling now. So do you predict how long our magnetic field lasts?
I don't know what the number is. I'm sure someone has predicted that. We're definitely still enjoying a strong magnetic field today.
What causes it to cool? Just over time it cools down?
That's right. Yeah, it's the heat that, believe it or not, you know, was generated when the planet first came together 4.5 billion years ago. So it just takes geologic time to cool something the size of a planet.
Interesting. Is Curiosity going to spend its entire life in Gale Crater?
It will. In fact, it'll spend it driving. Most likely, it'll spend its entire life driving uphill on this mountain. We chose the landing site at Gale Crater because it had this mountain in the middle of it, and the mountain consisted of layered rock. And it, you know, we hypothesized, we weren't sure until we got there, but it sure looked like some of the layers had clay minerals in them, which is a sign of ancient water. Other layers had different minerals, more salty minerals, for example. So even from the orbital mapping, we had hypothesized that as we climb up the mountain, we'll see environments change over time from one kind of climate to another. And so we knew we had, as long as the rover could last, every day of the mission would sort of be new because we'd be climbing higher and higher and getting to different, kind of a different record of ancient Mars over time. And that's how it's worked out, you know, and so we're just... maybe a little more than halfway of what looks to be a really interesting set of layers on the mountain. So if we can last another 3, 4, 5 years, we'll pretty much get through this entire layered sequence that we could see from space.
excuse me, Jane is in Denver, Colorado, and she says, I have read articles and I understand that there is some sort of controversy as to what the true color of Mars is. I understand that most of the images that we see of Mars have been colored. Can you talk about the actual color of Mars? What is it? Is it red, or what does Mars look like if you don't alter or photo touch or deal with the color?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll tell you a few things about that. Mars is generally reddish. It certainly is a red planet. If you look with your naked eye from Earth, you can even see that. And the main reason is because much of Mars is covered by dust and rock that's been oxidized. So the same reason that rust is red, the iron-containing minerals in rocks have been basically rusted and turned red. When you get a little bit more precise about that, I've heard some people say it's more like a yellow-brown or a salmon color. And that's, you know, but generally that's what it actually looks like. Now, the issue with colorizing images, we're guilty of that perhaps more than other missions, but it's intentional, and I can explain why we do that. Mars not only has all this dusty material on the surface, but it also has a very dusty atmosphere. The atmosphere is always like a bad smoggy day on Earth. You never have quite a clear day. And that dust-filled atmosphere creates a cast of light on the ground everywhere that's also this orange or salmon color. So when you take pictures with a camera on Mars, like we do with the rover, and don't process them, everything has an artificial cast of red just from the sunlight filtering through that dust in the atmosphere. So what we do is try to remove that so that we see the true color of the rocks on the ground rather than their how they're colored by the light filtering in. And we do that because the rocks and minerals on Mars are the same ones you'd find on Earth. There's basaltic rocks, and there's certain minerals that you'd find in the desert, you know, right outside of L.A. And the geologists we have on our mission, who are trained for, you know, decades to go out into the field and recognize things with their eyes, we make it so that they can see the same colors, the true color of the materials on Mars that they would recognize in similar environments on Earth. And so that's kind of a long way of saying, yeah, we process our images, but the intent is to remove the orange filtering of the sunlight.
So what is the true color of the Martian sky?
It's sort of a pinkish salmon, the same kind of color of most of the surface. And so the part that we get a lot of comments about, and I understand why we get them for sure, is that when we do our processing to bring out the true color of the rocks, it turns the sky blue.
Right.
And that that's unsatisfying because it makes it look like Earth, for one thing, and we really are on Mars. But it also is confusing because people are used to seeing that pinkish sky on Mars. I'll note that we release all of our images on the NASA website without any processing in their raw form. So they're all there. But often when you see the special mosaics or self-portraits and that sort of thing that the mission puts out, it's been processed.
The rocks that one sees going through Utah, for example, in Monument Valley or in other parts of Utah where the red rocks are and you have the pink desert sand, that's iron ore that's oxidation that causes all that red rock?
Yeah, it's
the same process?
Identical process to what we see a lot of on Mars.
So why is it primarily in Utah?
That's a good question.
So I mean, I've been all over the West, and I don't...
Yeah.
I mean, I love the red rock. I mean, I swipe it, and I have it, chunks of it sitting on my patio.
Yep.
I can't get enough of it. And, you know, I see some of it in Sedona, has some of it, you know, in that area, but that's very close to Monument Valley.
I think it's just the history. It's the type of raw materials that were there. So a lot of these same sedimentary rocks like we have on Mars, where there are things like sandstones that are porous and water can flow through them. And so when they're buried underground, groundwater flows through them, and it oxidizes the iron minerals, you know, precisely the same way it happens at Gale Crater on Mars. And by contrast, when you have something like the Sierra Nevada mountains, those are not sedimentary rocks. Those are volcanic rocks, igneous rocks. And they're a lot less porous, and water doesn't really flow through them in the same way.
And they don't look red.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure. Amazing. Are you expecting some unknown thing to show up and startle you in the remaining life of Mars? I mean, can you expect the unknown, or is that too much to ask?
We'd love it. I mean, that's how we learn, for sure. And I never want to place bets on something as dramatic as, like, you know, finding evidence of life, although it would sure make a nice career for me and the rest of our team. But we don't really count on that so much as just something, you know, else that'll tell us about the history of ancient Mars. I think one thing that could be really useful for our mission in Gale Crater is to see the lakes disappear. So now, you know, I've said a couple times how we've seen a 1,000-foot vertical thickness of ancient lake deposits, and we're still climbing and they haven't ended yet. If we could see Gale Crater, you know, dry up, if we could see the ancient record of when Mars lost its water, then we might be able to use our laboratories and other tools to understand why it happened and when it happened, and learn about how Mars went through this dramatic change from a wet planet to a dry planet.
But you haven't found that yet.
No, we expect that it's higher on the mountain. When we get to the layers on Mars, the layers in Gale Crater that are a little bit more, that have these salty minerals, we think they probably accumulated because the lakes were evaporating, just like you have on a dry salt lake on Earth.
How many more feet do you have to climb?
Probably about the same as we have. So the entire mountain is something like 16,000 feet high, but all of the interesting layers I've been describing are just in the bottom, you know, 2,000 feet or so.
So you need to climb roughly another 1,000 feet over the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. Rainey is in Portland, Oregon, with a question for you. And she said, how unique is Mars, as best as you can tell, from other planets? Is what you're learning about Mars useful for studying other planets in the solar system?
So Mars is unique in the sense that it's arguably the most Earth-like planet other than Earth. And so there's, of course, a few major distinctions in the solar system. You have the rocky planets close in, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and then you have the gas giants further out. And so Mars is similar to Venus and Mercury in the sense that it's a small rocky planet near the sun, but like Earth, it's probably the only other one besides Earth that had a lot of water at its surface for some long period of time. So, in a way, why we spend so much time and effort studying Mars is because it has the most possibility, we think, you know, to have had life originate on it after Earth. So, you know, in that sense, we sort of learn about ourselves and learn about Earth by studying Mars, because we're interested in seeing if life ever took hold there. There are a lot of other places in the solar system that may have also had life, now that we're finding all these oceans on moons that orbit these outer planets that are mostly gaseous. So Mars doesn't have a whole lot in common with them. But on the other hand, we're learning about how to look for life on in the solar system, and we can apply a lot of that that knowledge to searching for life on these other worlds.
I'm going to do one more question before we take our break because we're at the midway point. Randy is in Tucson, Arizona, and Randy says, given that you have found traces of water and that I believe you said it had the essential ingredients in it for life, why can't you make the statement that there was, or at least with a confidence interval of maybe 95%, past life on Mars? What's so hard about making that proclamation?
I guess you really wouldn't want to reach that conclusion unless you were very sure of it, very confident of it, because it's such a profound answer. We're still at the state where we don't know of any life in the universe other than what's on Earth, in spite of the fact that the more we learn about Mars, planets around other stars, just statistics suggest that there should be a lot of life in the universe, and there could even be other life in our own solar system. But it's the kind of question that you want to be very confident before you make such a claim. And curiosity is not equipped to find the kind of evidence that microbiology would leave 3 billion years ago. In other words, we're pretty confident there are no dinosaurs or birds or lizards or even tiny little seashell type organisms on Mars, because we would have found them by now. So if there was life, it probably was just bacteria. I mean, like microbiology. And 3 billion year old microbiology doesn't leave a lot of fossils behind. You have to have very sophisticated instruments to find it. So give us another few years to get Mars 2020 there, and hopefully we'll be able to give a much more confident answer.
But if you've got traces of water, and if the water had everything essential for life, why couldn't you draw the conclusion that there was life? Why would you have a situation with water and the essentials of life and no life? I mean, doesn't that seem stupid?
It doesn't seem stupid. It actually seems, I'd say that is the heart of the mystery. How could Mars have been so capable of supporting life, and yet life, for whatever reason, never took hold? It actually makes it much more profound that life did find a way to originate on Earth. You know, there's all this complex chemistry that how DNA first came together and how cells started replicating and all that. So there's a lot that has to go on from just starting with conditions that could support life to actually having life. And on Earth, for whatever reason, that chemistry happened. And on Mars, we don't know if it ever did, even if the conditions could have allowed it.
I'll delay the break. We got a caller, so I'll go ahead and take the call. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Yes, Tim. Go for it.
Yeah, I was wonder, are there any plans in the near future to utilize the small modular nuclear reactors that are being developed by NASA right now, known as Kilopower?
I'm not specifically familiar with those, but certainly we will need more advanced sources of power when we try to send humans to Mars. Solar panels are complex on Mars because of the dust that accumulates. So Curiosity is the first rover that on Mars that uses a nuclear power source. We have the same kind of nuclear power source that was used on Apollo and a lot of outer planet missions, which is plutonium that naturally decays over time and gives off heat. Other kinds of nuclear power sources, like even mini reactors and that sort of thing, would be needed to power the complex systems that will be needed when humans get there.
Yeah, that's basically what Kilopower is. It's a miniature nuclear reactor. I believe they're getting them as small as 1 kilowatt electric.
Wow. Yeah, no, I, that Sounds great. I'm glad that's being developed.
Anything else, Tim?
No, that's it.
Thank you for your call. So, listeners, we're going to take a pause. The toll-free number, if you would like to call us, and we do answer the phone during the break, is 1-866-687-7223. And, of course, email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And we'll be back in 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Space Show program tonight. And we have a couple of sponsors I would like to thank. Warbital ATK is the global leader in aerospace and defense technology and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. The AIAA is sponsored the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and again, they have 30,000 members, 88 countries, 95 or so corporate members, and their members are all busy shaping the future of aerospace every day. Check them out at AIAA.org. Better yet, attend their events. Great networking. You'll be happy you did it. Celestis is a sponsor. They're still the only provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services, proven Memorial Spaceflight Services in the world. They have 5 scheduled missions for this year. So one mission is the 7th Earthrise mission called Starseeker. This uses a suborbital up aerospace rocket from Spaceport America, and that is scheduled for April 2018. The 7th Earth orbital mission, the Heritage Flight, will be mid-2018 from the Cape aboard the General Atomics OTB satellite. That's on a Falcon Heavy rocket, and we know that thing works. We saw it today. Their second Luna mission, Luna 2, is fourth quarter of this year from New Zealand on the Moon Express spacecraft launched by the Rocket Lab Electron rocket. And that's the one I believe my mom and dogs might be on. I have to find out about that. Our 8th orbital mission, the Horizon flight, is also fourth quarter 2018. That goes from Vandenberg on a Falcon 9. And then their Voyager mission, the Enterprise flight, will also launch in fourth quarter 2018. And details will be available next month. If you want more information and want to talk about reservations, contact them at Celestis.com. And as I said, I am their customer, and they're a great company. So what a great way to honor somebody that loves space or that would really appreciate the ride. Ashwan, during the break, I asked you what level of confidence one had to have to say There's been past life on Mars, for example, and you talked about the need to find biosignatures. Can you explain the biosignature to us, please?
Sure, yeah. It was a good discussion we had briefly there during the break, because it clarifies why we can't say with curiosity that we have confidently found life. The distinction is that, you know, we found all the conditions necessary to support life. We found the water and the nutrients, but, you know, no life to make use of it. What you need to show that life actually took hold is some kind of trace of ancient life that you cannot explain by other natural, you know, abiotic means. So we call that a biosignature. It could be a texture in a rock. Sometimes there's material in the like algae or something that could create a texture in a rock that you'd be able to discover a million years later by how it's altered the rock. There's even more fine things like a pattern of chemicals, a pattern of minerals of the kind that life leaves behind and that otherwise doesn't commonly form naturally. And if you're able to find that, that would be a discovery that would maybe put us over the line of saying we have evidence of life on Mars.
And have we found anything that's close to a biosignature?
Not really. We have found, with curiosity, we found potential biosignatures, meaning that we have found things, patterns in chemistry and mineralogy that are similar to those left by life, but could also are also known to form naturally, as well. And so we can't tell which way they, have formed. And because you really want to get this question right, because of how important the question is, we would, you know, default to being conservative and say it must have formed naturally. So what we're looking for is that kind of chemical or mineralogical or textural piece of evidence that just doesn't form any other way, you know, by our experience on Earth.
So the fact that there is methane on Mars, that could be what you're talking about. It can form naturally, so you can't say it's coming from organic.
That is a perfect example. So we have found methane in the atmosphere of Mars, and not only have we found it, but we found it in a way that suggests that it is still actively being produced. So methane, if you were to just put methane in Mars' atmosphere today, you just open a jar and it comes out into the atmosphere, that methane would be destroyed in about 300 years just by being broken down by sunlight and that sort of thing. And so the fact that we detected it all means that because Mars formed a lot longer than 300 years ago, that something is continually replenishing that methane. And it very well could be biology deep underground somewhere that is adding that methane to the atmosphere. But because you can also add methane to the atmosphere from ultraviolet light breaking down meteors that come in with some carbon molecules on them, we know that there's this natural process that could do that same thing. So unfortunately, we can't distinguish between the two.
Bill is in Fort Worth, Texas, and he says, I have seen many articles on the web and many pictures purporting to say that there are fossils on Mars. I understand that there are kooky sites that have claimed this for years, but from what I'm looking at, they seem to be pretty credible, and the photographs seem to be pretty credible, that there might really be fossils on Mars. So you're a surface Mars guy. What have you to say about fossils on Mars?
The bottom line is, you know, we haven't found anything that we can confidently say is a fossil. And that's not only just from analysis of the pictures, but also the context of what that would imply. You know, a fossil that you could see with your eyes or see with one of our cameras would be a pretty advanced form of life. You know, like fossils that we're familiar with seeing in rocks on Earth, whether they're a leaf or an insect or fish, that's, you know, way down the road of evolution, where for much of the time on Earth, life on Earth consisted of microbes, and that's more likely to be the case on Mars. If life ever took hold on Mars, it probably was just microbes, which don't leave any fossils behind. So, you know, it's doubtful we would see an advanced form of life without any idea that even the simple forms of life ever took hold. But even putting that aside, the bottom line is that we see hundreds of thousands of rocks on Mars in these pictures, and they're all broken down by the wind and by meteors hitting them and by volcanoes going off, and they take all kinds of shapes and sizes. And it's, you know, there's just statistical odds that your eye is going to pick out a shape on that rock that your brain tells you looks like a fossil, but it's just the way that rock broke that, you know, that day it broke, it created a little pattern that looks like a fossil. And that's really, you know, 100% of what we see when we get these reports of fossils in our images.
How can you tell that it's not a real fossil? Is it because you haven't found simple life that would lead to advanced life? Is that kind of the theory that you use?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly in the back of our mind that it, again, it's so unlikely that we better look for the more natural explanation as good scientists. But even if we take that sort of, you know, someone else might call that a bias, you know, but so maybe let's put that aside. The pictures that I've seen, and I've, you know, seen probably most of them in terms of these claims, aren't that convincing. It's not like when you go to a store, you know, where you can buy a fossil on Earth and you see this precise outline of a leaf or a skeleton of a fish. Most of the time, it's just some arrangement of cracks or arrangement of bumps on a rock that, you know, our brains piece together and connect the dots in the, to the shape of a fish. And our brains are extremely good at that. You know, evolution has created our brains to find these patterns in everything we look at. But when you really examine it closely, it's, you know, it's pretty clear to us who are, you know, looking at these pictures all the time that it's not really a fossil.
So you don't think that there are any trace fossils on Mars of anything?
No, and I you know, again, I would love it if there were. Part of why we do this is to, actually really the main reason we do this is to try to see if life ever took hold on Mars, and it would be such an important and exciting discovery. I would love to say, yes, we found that, but honestly, unfortunately, we haven't.
So one of the emails that I've received on this subject talks about ancient microbial mats on Mars. And, you know, is and they, of course, the people sending me this believe the images really are fossilized microbial mats. So are you familiar with this concept?
Yeah, I'd say that was probably the most careful work that's been done to look at the images and see if they're, you know, by comparison with similar structures on Earth, if there's evidence for life. And so, yeah, let me first say that is a completely reputable study that was published in a journal. I think the only one of its kind that really made it all the way through peer review, scientific peer review. And so I don't want to impugn it at all. I'd say it's a great study. It's just, I think the majority of our team members on the mission itself still would say that all the features that were in that study could also just be the natural way the rocks have eroded at the site. And, you know, we're not convincing enough to us to make a claim that we had discovered life.
So Leonard David, who is a journalist, also sent me an article he wrote about MSL's Molly instrument or experiment. Or, do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, it's a camera on the end of our arm. Yeah.
Okay, and that claimed to show trace fossils that were real similar to, you know, what can be found here on Earth. So there seems to be, I get contacted by people that seems to suggest that there's a lot of smoke here, and I guess everybody's looking for the, you know, for the fire. I guess I don't know exactly how to say it, but
you're right, right.
But there's no tool. There's nothing that can say one way or another if a fossil has been found.
You know, again, if it were an obvious fossil, except for the case of these microbial mats that, you know, that are sort of their own thing, if an obvious fossil in terms of like a bone or a pattern in a rock or something, it would be obvious. You know, there wouldn't be any controversy about it. I think most of the things other than these microbial mats, the kind of things like that you're referring to with the Molly images, there was a recent case where there was just these little tubes, tube-like structures scattered around on the ground. And, you know, to one person that looks and sees a tube-like structures that seem out of place on a picture of Mars, gets excited about, you know, casts left by worms in the soil on Earth, which commonly form tube-like structures and as fossils on Earth. But again, you know, when you put it in the context of Mars and you see that rocks are eroding in all kinds of shapes and forms, and in one particular place you might gather a couple pieces of a rock that happen to be tube-shaped, you know, that's not something you can hang your hat on and say you've discovered life. It's just, you know, that just was not a responsible thing to do as a scientist.
Well, this would be, of course, past life if it was a fossil.
That's right, yeah.
Are you seeing pictures of these things that people Photoshop and fake, or are people just really serious about thinking that there might really be fossils in some of the sedimentary rocks?
I think people are genuine about it. You know, I think people are very excited about the prospect of finding life, and I don't fault them for that at all. But I think the vast majority of what I see coming across are people that look at a pattern of cracks in a rock and, you know, kind of draw a picture on it in the shape of a bone or a fish or something.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, you know, that's a set of cracks that just sort of looks like a fish. But it's not, it doesn't, you know, it's not something that you can prove is a fossil. It's just sort of a coincidence. And similar with these tube-like things. So it's... Yeah, that's really the mostly what we see is things that your brain would love to convince you that is something other than just a natural set of cracks in a rock.
What about the meteorites that make their way to Earth, and people say, you know, looks like there's fossils in the meteorites? Is there anything to any of that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a real exciting time. I think back probably 20 years ago now or something, when there were some meteorites found in Antarctica, and they were have determined to come from Mars, which a lot of meteorites on Earth, not a lot, but a good number of meteorites on Earth have originated from Mars. And when these were examined in the laboratory, there were some little structures that in a microscope looked a lot like fossilized bacteria. And this was studied in excruciating detail by laboratories around the world. And for the same reasons that I've been saying how careful you want to be before you make this claim, they kept it under wraps for, I think, for 2 years. And then they finally had a huge press conference, and, you know, Al Gore, I think, opened the press conference. And
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
At Stanford University, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it was exciting. And it actually... launched a lot of more interest in Mars exploration that still carries today. But amazingly, you know, another 5 or 10 years of study after that press conference has now caused the majority of scientists to no longer feel that that actually represented evidence of life. The structures were much smaller than similar bacteria on Earth, and there were other problems as well. I don't think it's been disproven, but I'd say the weight of evidence, the weight of opinion has now gone from positive to negative.
Boy, we're just never going to get to confirming life, either past or present. On Mars.
It is a little...
it's very frustrating.
I kind of sense that. No, I don't disagree.
If you were not climbing rocks in Gale Crater and the rover could actually make some decent time and could really move around on the surface, and it was just tooling around, randomly going to point A, point B, point C, you know, and maybe it had driven 100 miles from where it landed on Mars. What do you think it would have found? Would the conclusions, would the science, would what it be discovering be significantly different? Would it have been a better approach?
I don't believe so. We went to this site for a very particular reason, because we thought of all the places we could have sent this rover. This would be a site that not only would hold evidence of an ancient wet, life-friendly period on Mars, but would have multiple chances to find different environments, because every layer on this mountain would have been a record of a different time in Mars history. And by studying every time, we could do many experiments. At every point in Mars history, 3 billion years ago, and every sort of million or so years after that, we could continue to see, is it habitable? Is it still a warm and wet Mars, or is it drying out, or is it, you know, no longer friendly to life? And that's exactly what we've been able to do by deliberately and slowly climbing this mountain. So, this was a very strategic effort, and not one that was more just like, let's drive and see what we find. You know, we had a goal in mind that from day one that we're still following today.
So you wouldn't vote for a mission to land someplace where you could just randomly tool around the surface of Mars and see what you could find?
It's not a bad approach. It's just not our approach for this mission. You know, there's it's a philosophical difference that we actually talked about quite a bit when we were designing this mission. It's still early enough in the space age that you could still have, you know, what we were in our conversations calling Star Trek type missions, where you just, you know, for 5 years you just tool around and see what you find, because we're not smart enough to know what's out there yet. So chances are, even on a random walk, you're going to find something really interesting. But on the other hand, the other side of the coin, a couple decades into Mars exploration, we are starting to get smart enough to ask more specific questions and to actually be guided by a hypothesis. You know, like, we see this crater on the surface. It has this layered mountain. Some of the layers are made out of clay. We're going to hypothesize that this was a place that could have supported life, and let's go figure out if we were right. And we chose that latter approach instead of the Star Trek approach for curiosity.
Beth is in Seattle. You'll love this question. Many of us still believe that there is merit in exploring Cydonia. Why won't NASA go there? Taxpayers' money should rule, and if enough citizens that pay taxes want to see what's really at Cydonia instead of the NASA hype, which many of us believe exists, why won't you do a mission there? It's our money that's paying for these missions. That's what she says. So, comments? I know that's above your pay grade. But.
Yeah, I'm not going to speak for NASA, exactly. I'll give sort of two answers. When, you know, NASA has a Mars exploration program that has the end goal of discovering life on Mars. And so, you know, as I was pointing out earlier, we have a multi-decade set of steps to get there. And you know, every mission is designed with a certain payload and goes to a certain place to lead us to that eventual ability to see if there was life on Mars. So that's the program NASA's followed, and Cydonia didn't play a role in that because it wasn't thought to be a place, you know, by the scientists involved in developing the strategy that played a role in that. I think as a I put on a different hat and just say I'm a taxpayer too, and we live in a democracy, so I actually kind of resonate with what you said about if enough of the public thinks it's important, we should do it. I would just say, you know, get people together and make your case.
So so NASA doesn't have any plan, although maybe they should have a plan that says, okay, once every decade we'll do a mission that the taxpayers vote on. So everybody who wants to do something special on Mars or go something special, send us your vote. And, you know, the winning vote, you know, will prevail, and we'll see if we can plan a mission to go there. They've never probably thought of doing anything democratic like that.
That's right.
Because the scientists prevail, and they're more important than democracy. But I feel for Beth because I think, you know, taxpayers should be able to have a say. Maybe they wouldn't want to go to Cydonia. Maybe only a handful would. But it is our money. It'd be nice if we could play a role in how that money is spent.
I don't disagree with you. I'll say that there's a democratic way that NASA works in the sense that for all these missions, they depend on scientists all across the country and even around the world to propose the best ideas. And NASA listens to these scientists, so they're not all NASA employees, et cetera. They're just regular taxpayers who happen to be scientists. Now,
but regular Joe is stopped out of that, and Mary Sixpack, they're not part of that process.
Yeah, I think you're right. And one thing that could, an opportunity that I think we'll see is that as you get into more and more of these private enterprises having the capability to go to Mars, there'll be more opportunities to do things like this.
Well, I hope. I think it would be real interesting if you had democratic plans of where to go study on Mars based on how taxpayers wanted to see their money spent. I think that'd be a real novel approach to at least a portion of the Mars exploration program. You do have another one that you'll probably really love. So Joshua's in Salt Lake City, and Joshua says, I'm surprised that the moons of Mars have not come up in this discovery. Is there any reason to explore the moons of Mars for evidence of past or possible existing microbial life around or on Mars?
I'll give you a couple answers. I think, you know, from one respect, the moons of Mars, which are captured asteroids from asteroids captured a long, long time ago, don't have a lot of the same characteristics that the surface of Mars would have in terms of being able to potentially support life. You know, like the little moons of Mars never had an atmosphere, never had running water, etc. You know, where on the surface of Mars 3 billion years ago, we had all those things. So that's why the surface is a lot more appealing than going to the moons. But what the moons have, how they do come up these days in terms of exploring Mars, is the idea that if you're going to send humans or even more advanced robots to Mars, the moons might be a good place to test arriving and exploring as a stepping stone to learning how to land something very big and complex on the surface. The other thing the moons might do is give you a little, you know, like a little command post that you can be in orbit around Mars and direct things that are going on the surface, like a little natural space station. Another idea I've heard is that the moons collect debris that has also been kicked off of Mars by meteors. So there could actually be Mars meteorites on Phobos and Deimos that are much easier to collect than going all the way down to the surface and having to land through that atmosphere. So even when you're talking about setting Mars, the planet, there's a lot of good, interesting uses for the moons.
But the moons of Mars are not part of NASA's plan for exploring Mars and searching for past life?
No, not directly, but the ideas that I was just going through are on the table for being part of these future missions, like having a little outpost on the moon, even when most of the action is going on the surface.
Fascinating. Do you personally think there was past life on Mars? And could it have been advanced life, or are we only talking about the possibility of microbial life?
I do think that one day we're going to find evidence of life on Mars. And it's really just the kind of logical scientific person in me that says that, because odds are that, you know, like we were talking about earlier, why wouldn't life have taken hold of such a wonderful environment for it? If we found that there was water and nutrients and all kinds of friendly, you know, chemicals that life could use as raw material, and life as we know it is so robust and so clever at exploiting these kind of environments, why shouldn't it be there? You know, it just seems like the rational view now is that life was on Mars, and yet it's a mystery how we haven't found it. Your second question about would it be simple or complex, there I'm less positive. I think probably it never really got beyond a very simple form because we would have seen the easier evidence at this point if it was a larger life form.
Well, if New York were destroyed and had been destroyed for, you know, 2 billion years, what would be left of it if you went to Earth and you were standing where New York City was? Would you find something that was 2 billion years old to tell you that there was a huge city there of millions and millions of people?
I think so. You know, just same way you could find fossils of, you know, once life got beyond just, you know, multicellular organisms, then you started having bones and shells and that sort of thing, then all of a sudden it can survive. Doesn't survive everywhere. Probably most fossils never survive, but there are places like, you know, famous places in Africa where a lot of fossils are found, or Utah where dinosaur bones are found, certain environments that are just better, that have these sort of magical list of combinations of characteristics that preserve fossils for a billion years. And Mars should have those special environments as well. I think if there were advanced life on Mars, and if we looked hard enough, we would come across the places where the environment would have preserved it.
This is going to be another strange one for you. This is from Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, in Atlanta. And he says, David likes to have a friend of his who is a nuclear plasma physicist by trade come on the show, who has a theory that there were very large nuclear bombs or explosions on Mars because of the isotopes found in the Martian atmosphere and the deposits of thorium at different spots on the Mars surface. I'm not sure if you are familiar with Dr. John Brandenburg and his theories. He has spoken at many established and reviewed conferences, including Packing the Rooms at AIAA. Do you have any knowledge or information about his theories about nuclear bombs on Mars 100 million years ago due to different isotopes found in the Martian atmosphere that are characteristic of coming about because of our atmospheric nuclear bomb testing earlier on in the 40s and the 50s, and the thorium deposits?
No, unfortunately, I don't. I know we haven't seen anything like that with our mission, but that's not really our specialty either, to look at those
isotopes.
Radioisotopes, yeah.
How does thorium get on the surface of Mars?
That's a little beyond my expertise. I mean, there's a certain amount of radioactive material that's in all natural rocks. And that's how we mine, you know, uranium and things like that on Earth. So Mars would have similar concentrations of radioactive material just naturally occurring underground. But I don't know how it might get concentrated in one spot or another.
Because there are maps that show where thorium is located on the surface of Mars, but so you're thinking it could just be there naturally.
Right. Yeah, I'm just not familiar enough with what Mr. Brandenburg is describing.
Okay. Well, that will probably take us toward the end of the program. He packs my show when he comes on. People love the theories, and then of course the blog goes crazy with this half saying, you know, he's a quack and a fake and a fraud, and this half championing the cause. It's kind of like the Face on Mars stuff. So one needs to get to Mars with boots on to go see what's really there in many places. So when do you think that might happen?
You know, all I can do is repeat what the people at NASA say who are working on this. I'm busy working with a robot, but I have colleagues, of course, across NASA who are busy preparing for human exploration, and the timetable they're saying is still in the 2030s, which is getting closer. It's, you know, less than 20 years away now. So,
would you want to go walk around on Mars? Would you like to go?
I never know how to answer that. I'm perfectly happy to keep working with robots. But, you know, if it gets to the point where we can go and it's pretty safe, man, I would love to go hike up Mount Sharp where the rover is today.
And the problem, of course, is a long trip. We need to find a way to shorten the trip.
Yeah.
You know, and make it more palatable. So, well, I'd love to go to Mars to visit, but I don't know that I'd want to spend a couple of years there.
That's right.
But, yeah, it would be fun to hike around and explore some of these things if we could do it and not get radiated and come back okay. What's next in your work? You're just continuing on Curiosity until it fails. Is that the plan?
That's the plan. Of course, at JPL, the focus is quickly shifting to the future missions. We got a lander launching in May called InSight, which is going to put a seismometer on the surface of Mars for the first time and look for Mars quakes, and more importantly, use Mars quakes as a way of probing the interior of Mars by watching seismic waves bounce off of different layers below the ground. So that's very exciting. And then 2020, we'll launch, you know, in just 2 years from now and send a rover that looks a lot like Curiosity to a different part of Mars with a different payload that's capable of finding these biosignatures that we talked about.
Do you think that Mars is even close to being as geologically active as Earth vis-a-vis earthquakes?
It doesn't have plate tectonics, so it's missing the force that drives most of the earthquakes on Earth, the shifting plates. But it does have meteors that hit the planet. And like we talked about earlier, it's still cooling. And as you cool, the surface shrinks and it gets wrinkled. And those wrinkles, you know, so to speak, will cause Mars quakes also.
You know, I have this earthquake app on my iPhone, and I have it set to give me alerts on anything over 4, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that there's a day that goes by where there aren't 20 or 30 alerts with earthquakes around the world, from happening here in the United States to Alaska to the Pacific to who the heck knows where. I mean, places that I can't even pronounce. I had no idea that there were so many daily earthquakes on Earth. And if I change it to two and above, it just goes off the chart.
Yep.
So Earth must just, you know, have thousands of earthquakes a year. I mean, it is really geologically active.
It is, yeah. The fact that all the continents and oceans are just this tiny little thin skin on the top of a planet that's still churning, you know, with all the heat that it formed with, causing the plates to shift around. You know, it's amazing that we all survive. Sometimes I think, you know, because huge forces at work underneath us.
Oh, unbelievable. All over the place. I mean, Oklahoma, Iowa, you know, California. But then you go to Taiwan. Taiwan's been getting hit with big earthquakes lately. Mm. And then, of course, in the South Pacific. And I never dreamed there was so much geological activity. I just couldn't. I'm stunned every time I open the app up. And it gives you little alerts. So it has like the number 9. Meaning there's 9 earthquakes to look at since the last time I checked the app. I mean, it's just an endless array of earthquakes on our planet. Is that because we have plate tectonics?
Yeah, that's the primary reason. The magma below the Earth is still turning around and convecting, and that moves the plates around. And Mars doesn't have that anymore, you know, because as we talked about earlier, it's cooled down and the crust has gotten very thick and rigid. But sometimes that rigid crust still contracts as the planet cools and shrinks, and then you can get some good earthquakes on Mars today.
Well, maybe that seismometer will spin off into an app for our iPhones, and we can then get a reading on every time there's a Mars quake.
It really should. I mean, someone's planning that.
I hope so, because this is totally cool app for nuts like me who want to see where earthquakes are happening around the world. It's really very informative, so I hope they do that with the Mars. Listen, this has been a real pleasure. I want to thank you for joining us again on the Space Show, and if it's okay with you, we'll check in with you later on and see if we found any biomarkers yet.
Yeah, I hope I can tell you we have. Thank you very much for having me.
I hope so, too, and I do look forward to talking to you again. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Yep.
Listeners, that's it. So come back Friday and Sunday for our regular Space Show program. Special thanks to Ashwin and to those of you who emailed us and those of you who called. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Keep looking up. Good night from the Space Show.